And the usual thank you to Chava for taking the kids tonight. Thank you for coming early. So on the week two of the Halachic Mythbusters, right? Silverware gardens and other kosher kitchen fabrications. So who's familiar with these silverware gardens? How many people here have ever planted a silverware garden?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so. So there is. So for regular kashrus issues, right, there is very little basis for anything having to do with the ground, like especially leaving the ground for a couple of days, a couple of weeks, right? Very, not much going on there. As we will cover. So we'll attempt to. There's, I guess, on the list here are three topics. I don't know if we're going to get to the third one. The first one are these silverware gardens. So that's going to be an example of something that there's a mythology that we do something, and we're going to show what really is the basis or whatever basis there actually is for it. A second thing is we want to talk about this idea that there's an idea that's out there that you're allowed to use something once before bringing it to the mikvah. So that also is a myth that does not really have much base. We'll talk about where my theory about where that may have come from, but we will discuss that. And then finally, the third thing I want to discuss is the idea of blood spots and eggs. Blood spots and eggs, that's spelled E-G-G-S, not E-G-G-E-S. Blood spots and eggs. So let's begin. So the silverware garden. So the first two, the idea of Haggalah, the idea of kashering, as well as the idea of mikvah, are actually both based on the same sets of psukim. At the end of a war with Midian, so that's the first source on the page. So Vayomer Elazar HaKohen al Anshei HaTzavah Be'im L'Milchama Zosku Kasat Torah. So Elazar HaKohen tells the people that are coming back from war that this is a chok of the Torah. Asher Tzivah Hashem Es Moshe, that Hashem commanded Moshe. So Ach Es HaZahavi Es HaKesef Es HaNechoshe Es HaBarzel Es HaBedil Ves HaFeres are all these different types of materials that you may have picked up. Kol Dabar Asher Yavo Ba'ish Taviru Ba'ish V'Taher. Right, anything that came in contact with fire should come in contact with fire and therefore will be pure. So there's three things here that are in this pasuk, and that makes it pretty confusing, right? Number one, it says anything that came in contact with fire has to come in fire. Then it says something having to do with meinida, which is a reference to mikvah, right? It's something having to do with some kind of tumantara thing. And then it says whatever did not come in contact with the fire, so you have to actually put into the water. So this is the basis for our kashering things, and the idea that we talked about, I think, we talked about the idea of Kabbalah Kachpolta, the idea that just as something is absorbed, it goes out. So the same way, and this is really the basis for all ideas of kashering back and forth, you basically have to know what the material is made out of, and you have to know how it was used. And finally, that's pretty much it. You have to, and when it was used. So those are the three things any rabbi is going to need to know, or when it was used, previous time, whatever. And that's how you kasher things. If it was used directly on fire, so you have to kasher it by putting a fire directly to it. And if it was used with a liquid medium, so then you have to kasher it by using some kind of liquid medium, which is what we're familiar with, right? You have a big pot, you throw it in the pot, and in theory all this stuff comes out. I think we pointed this out during the kashrus.
The
stone is to kasher the pot. Right, how do you kasher a pot? So you put it in a bigger pot. And how do you kasher the bigger pot? Well, you put that in a bigger pot. But ultimately, there's no bigger pot. So how are you going to kasher the biggest pot in the world? So what's the basis for that? So the stone in theory causes the water to overflow. In theory, that kasher is the pot, and therefore you can kasher in that kasher pot. Technically, you don't even need a kasher pot. By a standard kashering that takes place where you let the thing sit for 24 hours and then you're kashering it later and you're poshering in a pot much larger than itself, generally speaking, the idea of having the pot itself doesn't even need to be kosher. But that's for another time. I don't really want to cover the laws of Haggalah's Kalim this evening. So you put in a boiling pot, etc. So then you are good to go. So that's the general issue. So where did this idea of the silverware garden? So some have this idea. I remember this idea and going up to my house, I don't think we used to, like, something was strafe, you put it in the ground for like 2 weeks or whatever, a week, a day, whatever it is, and then it comes out later and it's kashered somehow. So how does that doesn't exist? That's not one of the ways that the psukim that the psukim describe the kashering of vessels. So where did that? I mean, that just come out of thin air? So very little in Yiddishkeit comes out of thin air. And you can find a source for almost anything. Sometimes it's a weak source, sometimes it's a bad source, and sometimes it's it doesn't fit in at all. But everything has some kind of source, some kind of, you know, in that big mesechta called Baba Maisa, right? There's many different exchanges. So where did this come? There is something about sticking things into the ground, and that's used in a very specific context, and we'll learn about that context this evening. It is relevant, it is practical today. So the Gemara in Chulin, and Achesam Beis, source number 2, points out the following din. That Ashochi Basachet Shal Odei Kochavim. Let's say, right, you shecht an animal, right, and lo and behold, you realize that it was the McDonald's shechting knife. Right? You look at it, and there's like the little golden arches on it. Oh my gosh! It's the non-kosher. It's the one that you use to shecht pigs. Whatever it is, it happened to be not kosher. So and then you shechted with it. So is the animal that you shechted then not kosher? Right? So the Gemara says no. There's two possibilities of what you either need to do. Rav Amar Kolef, Rav Arachana Amar Madiach. So Kolef is you cut off the area where you cut, and you just get rid of that part. And Rav Arachana says no. All you have to do is like wipe it away. If just wipe it away, that should be good enough. So Leim of a Hakamifli. So maybe the dispute is right. Beis Hashchita Tzonei Numarsar Beis Hashchita Rotach. Right? There is an idea that the area where you shechted the animal had some kind of heat. So the Gemara has a question, well, how hot is that area, right? So is it hot enough that it will actually absorb from that knife? So if there's non-kosher flavor contained within that knife, it might actually get absorbed into the animal. Or do we say, come on, that area is not warm at all, it's actually, you know, it's not considered enough to affect the transfer of taste. So all you have to do is just wipe away that area. Okay? So then the Gemara has another possibility, and then the Gemara says, so Ika da Amri, there are those that say, D'chula yam beis hashchita tzonin, that everybody agrees that the area of shchit, I mean the area where the neck of the animal, where it's shechted, is actually cool, right? It wouldn't affect blios. There would be no absorption of flavors back and forth. So manda amr madia, so the one who says that all you gotta do is wipe it away, clean it off, whatever, so that's shapir, that's fine. Manda amr kolei, but the one that says that there is some type of absorption, what kind of absorption could there be if everything is cold? So the Gemara answers, agav ducha desakina bala, that because of the sharpness of the knife, so that caused an absorption. So what this Gemara seems to be saying is that when you're talking about a knife, right, a knife will affect an absorption into something, right, regardless of whether there's heat or not. Okay, that's the right. Usually, if you stick a spoon, right, a milchic spoon into your chicken soup, right. So that will, and chicken soup is hot, so the milchic taste will. Right, you basically just taste up your spoon, right. But if the chicken soup was cold, so all you really have to do is rinse off your spoon and you know wipe it clean and you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to kasher it. So here the Gemara is saying that even though the area where you shecht it is actually cold, still you're going to have to do some kind of kashering process. It still was an exchange of taste from the knife to the animal. So how did that take place? Right? If we assume that transferring would only take place by way of heat, so how does it take place if the Gemara says the animal is completely cold, right? That area is cold. So the Rashba, yeah?
Blood is hot.
Right, but the Gemara knows that.
Maybe the skin is.
No, the Gemara knows the heat of blood, but blood is 98.6. I don't know what it is in cows, but by humans it's 98.6. So 98.6 probably isn't enough to affect the transfer of heat. 98.6 probably isn't yassel lettuce, but so therefore the taste wouldn't transfer. So. So the Gemara answers, so the Rashba explains. So So, you know, before we get to the Rashba, so the Gemara explains duch de sakina bala. So what is that answer? The answer is that the intensity of the knife, the fact that you're doing a cutting action, right? A spoon, you dip in a spoon, you take it out. But when there's a knife, there's an intensity of the cutting action. So the intensity of the cutting action, even though it's not very warm, will still affect the transfer of heat. Okay, that's the answer to the question, right? So a knife has a special halacha, right? If you're cutting with a knife, if you're cutting something, right? No, not just you dip, if you, not just if, well, probably not if you, we'll see, if you use a knife as a stir, but if you actually cut with a knife, so cutting with a knife actually takes the place of heat going back and forth. So the
with heat, the transfer of taste, there's some intuitive understanding that taste can transfer from one to the other. So that's almost like a scientific.
Yeah, what's the physics?
Right.
So, for thousands of years, the Ravonim have been wondering whether there's actually a physical, chemical, whether this actually is a real scientific halacha. And I think we pointed out here during the Pesach Shir that this parsha is introduced by the words Zos Chukas HaTorah. Right, this whole parsha is introduced with these are halachos of taste. These are the way the Torah has chosen to define their halachos of taste. So there's a story there. There's a Radbaz. There's a truth of the Radbaz where he talks about an experiment that he did. Right, you've sort of seen that he did this experiment that he made something and then had it cook something and he weighed it before and after and there's a difference in weight. It's a little hard to kind of jump. I think I've heard that in YU, some of the chemistry professor did his experiment and there was no difference. Right? So it's a little hard to figure out scientifically what's going on. The Torah defines the rules, and the Gemara defines the rules, and I think that's what we, you know, in a way it's an alternate scientific physical universe, but we, you know, we live with that.
It's not scientific, it is
what
it is.
Right. So the Rashba writes, so the Rashba says, so how is their taste going back and forth? Usually, the only time you have to be concerned with this thing is, with taste going back and forth, technically, is when it's considered a ben yomo, when it has been used in the previous 24 hours. If it hasn't been used in the previous 24 hours, so then you don't have to worry about taste going back and forth, because any taste that was absorbed into the vessels, right, already doesn't exist, or it exists, but exists in a very slifkam. It's not adding good taste. So the Rashba says, well, one possibility is to say that it was a knife that had been used in the last 24 hours. It's a knife that had been used in the last 24 hours. You combine that with the idea that you're using, you're pushing power into it. You're using duch de sakina, right? You have the strength of the knife, right? You combine the two of those together. That will cause taste to transfer into the animal. However, the Rashba gives another possibility. The Rashba says, "How is that? What taste is transferring in?" So he says, "The shiny sachin that a knife is different. The afilu b'she'enu ben yomo. This is source number three. That even if it hasn't been used in the last 24 hours, lo have no sintam lefgan. It's not considered like the taste has gone back el lishvach, but the taste is still good. Why? The suro toach al panav, because the taste is still on the face of the knife. The lo amru, and we don't say b'she'enu ben yomo shehu lefgan el be'isr balua b'dofnei hakli pogmo. They says that what are we talking about? When do we say that this 24 hours, that this idea that taste goes bad when it's absorbed and it's been there for more than 24 hours, when do we assume that works? That's only when, right, that's only when it's only taste that's absorbed within the vessel, right? You have a pot, right, and there's stuff absorbed within the pot, right? So after 24 hours, it's not that taste isn't considered viable anymore. But if the taste is sitting on the pot, it wasn't absorbed, it's just the pot's dirty, right? So that's considered, what do we call that? We call that a dirty pot, right? We call that, right, meat or cheese or whatever it is that's stuck to the inside of the pot. So what the Rashba is saying is that with a knife is, for whatever reason, a knife is a magnet to dirt. The knives never actually get very clean. But the knives never actually get very clean. So if you use a knife, right, to cut something, right, so that intensity of the cut will make it hot, right? It hasn't been used in 24 hours. It doesn't matter, because the fat's still sitting on the face of the knife. right? And that fat is actually going to be absorbed, right? The real taste is actually going to be absorbed into the rest of the animal, and therefore that animal is going to require some kind of kasher. So that's the Rash was coming up with an idea, a very important idea, right? That knives are considered dirty. At least knives during the time of the Gemara is considered dirty, and therefore the stuff that's on the cover of the knives, right? The idea of the 24-hour not delay, the 24-hour rule that if it's more than 24 hours, good taste doesn't really transfer, does not apply to knives. So how do you clean knives then? So then there's a Gemara in the end, the last Gemara in Avodah Zarah. It's not the last Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the very last Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Might not be appropriate for all audiences. You could look it up yourself. But the second to last Gemara in Avodah Zarah talks about these knives, and it says Tanya Nami Hachi. We have this price that teaches that a sachin yafa she'in bo gumus, that if you have a knife that doesn't have any ridges, no atza asara pamin bakarka. You stab it into the ground 10 times. Amar Rav Huna b'Rei d'Rav Yehoshua lechol batzonin. What are you allowed to do with that? If you stab into the ground 10 times, you can then use it to eat cold things. So what's that Gemara meaning? Well, why can't you eat cold things with it before you stabbed into the ground 10 times? So the Rashba is going to say, that's what I'm talking about, right? Because the only if taste absorbed into the knife, right? He absorbs into knife, so then you need heat for it to transfer in and out. Here we're saying that it could transfer even without heat. Alright, but yet we are concerned that there's going to be taste on it that's going to absorb into whatever food you're cutting. Right? So answers the Gemara. No. Answers the Gemara that you clean it off. How do you clean off a knife? So the real way to clean off a knife is to take it and stab it into the ground 10 times. If you stab it into the ground 10 times, that will clean all the schmutz off of the side of the knife.
That's if it's unserrated.
Right, so you say, well, serrated, I'm not sure if that's what it means, serrated. Gumos means like grooves.
It's not smooth like our knives are.
Right. It means more like the side of the knives, or cuts, right. Right. I think our knives, that even though they are, I guess, technically serrated, I don't think that's what the Gemara is referring to. Right? The Gemara is referring to that there's like a rivet, or like there's something that actually something gets stuck in. That wouldn't really be by our knives. So that's, as far as I know, the only source for sticking things into the ground.
But I still don't understand why do you have to clean it off? I mean, in other words, if you're going to use it, if it's a fleshek knife and it has meat on it, and you're going to use it for fleshek, why do you have to stick it in the ground 10 times?
No, you don't. If it's a fleshek knife, that's fine.
Right.
We're saying if you want to use it for something parv, if you want to use it for some advice, you got to make sure it's clean. So how do you make sure that it's clean? So the Gemara said you got to stick it in the ground 10 times. Those are for most very modern day authorities. If you look in, I don't know if we have it. We do have it. The Rav Forrest Kashrus book, and he quotes opinions of Yaakov Kamenetsky. He quotes Yaakov Kamenetsky Sefer on Shulchan Aruch. They quotes a saying that today our modern day applied things such as like steel wool or the back of the sponges or things like that probably qualify to clean the knives up pretty well. So you don't really have to, but it lives on in the silverware gardens. Anyway, so we realize that the application of these of sticking things into the ground is very limited and is really only applies to knives and doesn't really, practically speaking, shouldn't really apply today at all. There aren't really any practical examples, I would think, that one would l'chachil go ahead and do this. We have other ways of cleaning things up. So that is the appropriate way to kasher is to use heat and to use, or if it requires libun, it requires a fire, so you figure out a way to do it with a fire, but not to sticking it into the ground is not really an appropriate way to kasher. It doesn't work. It doesn't work to kasher anything. Yes?
So how do you go from Gemara to stick in the ground 10 times?
Right.
How do we get from that to the notion of planting it in the ground?
Yeah, I don't know. You could, I don't know.
What are the properties of dirt? I mean, it's funny that you would think it has to be a hook because how could dirt clean something?
No. Dirt does clean.
Dirt's
an abrasive. The idea is that it's an abrasive, right? The Gemara talks about dirt for cleaning things. Yeah. Dirt's not necessarily dirty. It's just whatever. Anyways, philosophical comment. All right. Anyway, so that's the idea, the silverware garden. So that hopefully is a thing of the past. The next thing I want to talk about is this one time before tefillah. So this idea of tefillah's kelim in general is also learnt out from that pasuk, that first source on the page that we talked about, that kol devar asher yavo be'esh tavir be'esh v'taher ach b'meinida yischata. So the Gemara points out that what's the word v'taher being used, what's the idea of meinida being used. The Gemara points out that it's v'taher means that there's also a requirement to bring it to the mikvah, right? And what kind of mikvah? So the Gemara tells us the b'meinida, the same types of mikvah, mikvahs that a woman uses. So just men, I'm not sure what the status is of the men's mikvah here, but many men's mikvahs are not up to the standard, right? So if you just have to go into the men's mikvah, I did this once before I knew this halacha. I was going, anyways, it was Erev Yom Tov, so I took this, no one was looking, I kind of, you know, stuck it. Apparently that's not practical, that's not a good idea. Because it's kind of nasty. And the second, well, you clean it afterwards anyways, that's the big deal. But the second reason is because the men's mikvahs don't necessarily reach up to the standard. I don't know the status of the mikvah here, but generally speaking, so it requires tefillah in a mikvah that would be relevant, that would be usable for women to go to as well. So that's the halacha. There's a little bit of a question whether that's a din d'oraisa or whether it's a din d'rabban. Now most Rishonim assume that it's a din d'oraisa. It's actually being learned out from a pasuk. The Rambam seems to say that maybe, perhaps, is saying that it's only d'rabbanan, it's only a rabbinic law. Either way, one is required to bring all. It's a mitzvah to bring all of your things to all of the relevant kelim to bring them all to the mikvah. So the Rambam then writes, what about before you have used it? But before you have brought it to the mikvah, is there a probe? I mean, we just spelled out that there is a mitzvah to bring it to the mikvah. Is there any, what about if you haven't had a chance to bring it to the mikvah yet? Is there a prohibition in using it? Right? Are you allowed to use it before bringing it to the mikvah? So again, this is also a dispute. Most assume that you are not allowed to. The Rambam writes, "Halkeich titashri suda mina akum." If you buy some type of vessel that's going to be used for a meal from a non-Jew, "Mutimatechus v'klizchuches," whether it's going to be metal or whether it's going to be glass, "Devarim shelo nishtamish behen kol iker mitavlin b'mei nida." Right? If it hasn't been used, right? You put it into a mikvah. "Va'achar kach yu mutarim lechol behem melishos," and only afterwards that you then allowed to use it in order to eat from, in order to drink from. I mean, you say that you can't use it before you bring it to the mikveh. That seems to be the implication of the Rambam. Shulchan Aruch, or the Ramah, codifies that. The Ramah writes, this is the Haggadah, this is all the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch. Rishon Asur Lishtamish, right, it says, Aval Harishon Asur Lishtamish Bo Litzarchi Suda, you're not allowed to use it for the Suda. Afilu Derech Arai, even like on a one-time deal, below Tefillah. Right, you're not allowed to do it at all. That you're not allowed to, so this idea, right? So this idea that you that's out there, that you could use something once before bringing it to the mikvah, right? So the Ramah clearly says no, no way, nothing doing. You buy something in the store, you're not allowed to use it until you bring it to the mikvah. There are a couple. So that's the halacha. Now where did this idea come from, right? That's the part of the mythology, right? So you got to figure out A, whether it's right, whether it's wrong, and then B, if it is incorrect, well, what's it based on, right? It didn't just come up out of thin air. So it didn't come out of, I think what it is based on is the following. Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he discusses aluminum pans, right? He says, that's source number 9. Hine kelim ha'asuyim l'shimush pam achas, ki'al harbe pamim enam ru'uyim. Right, something that you bought to use once, because to use it many times, it's not befitting. V'ruva de'alma enam doch ken atzman. Right, and most people don't, they don't use it more than that because they don't cost that much money, and they're meant to be used only once. However, there are some people that use it two or three times. Do they require tefillah? And basically Rav Moshe says, no, that doesn't have the status of a kli, it doesn't have the full status of being something permanent. And tefilas kelim, in order for something to be chayiv, something to be obligated, to be brought to a mikvah, right, there's a very important qualification for something to be chayiv, for something to be obligated, tefilas kelim, and that is that it must be a kli. Right, it must actually be a vessel. So Rav Moshe Feinstein explained that something that's only temporary does not have the status of a full-blown vessel, and therefore the mitzvah of tevilas kelim doesn't apply to it. So all those aluminum foil pans, there are those that are machmir and say that one should bring to the mikvah, right? Rav Moshe says that no, and not just, you can even use it more than once, he clearly says. Even if you use it two, three, four times, as long as it's something that's not going to be a permanent fixture by you, so the aluminum foil pans do not have to be brought to the mikvah. But that might be the source for the idea of the one-time usage, right? Because right here you see something that we say, well, you're going to use it, since you're going to be using it once or twice, you don't have to bring it to the mikvah. Right, so that may be the source for the idea for bringing it once. So on that note, so Rav Moshe has a different tshuva, a second tshuva about the coffee cans, right? What's the shiloh with the coffee cans, right? The coffee cans, you know, that... Yeah. What do you think would be what? Can you put cookies in the coffee cans, right? I mean, the first chew that we talked about was the aluminum foil pans. So aluminum foil pans, right, how many times really can you use them, right? You can't really use them, right? After a while they get shaky. Once, twice, three times, right, they get messed up, they get torn, right? You can't really use them more than that. However, there are things on the market, like the coffee glass bottles or the cans or the Snapple bottles or all those kinds of things that are made of glass or metal that in theory, when they're made in the factory, are made to be disposable, right? They are disposable things. But yeah, people can use them and you can keep them and they'll last the whole run, right? They'll last as long as you need them to last. So do those things require tevilas kelim? Right, so there's two questions on that. Number one is, can you even use them once before bringing them to the mikvah? I mean, you buy a Snapple can, a Snapple bottle in the store. So are you allowed to drink from that Snapple bottle? Right, you're drinking from a glass bottle that you own, that you just brought from a non-Jew, that never been brought to the mikvah.
But why do you start counting Africans for them? Why don't you start counting before you...
No, that's what I'm asking. Maybe as soon as you buy it, you have to pour it out and drink from something else. Right? That's question A. And then question B is, right, let's say you decide then that I'm going to use... This is going to be my my storage for all of my paper clips. Right? So, well, not paper clips isn't such a good example. But for all my jelly beans. I'm going to keep all my jelly beans in the Snapple bottle. Right? So does it then require to be a scale? So Rav Moshe Feinstein says here as well, and both notes that the answer is no. First, he starts off by saying that that when you buy the bottle with the stuff inside, so the bottle really isn't like you don't really care about the bottle. Right? If you could somehow manage to just buy the Snapple without the bottle, right? You'd be happy to do so. It just would be somewhat inconvenient. You wouldn't be able to keep it in the car very long. So because the bottle is kind of like a klachar yad, kind of like a bag, you know, it's not really something that you're buying for the usage of being a vessel, right? And it was never intended in the factory to be a permanent vessel, right? So therefore it doesn't require tefilas kelim to use it once. What about to use it more than that? So Rav Moshe writes here, so he writes here as well, in this source here, in source number 10, with regards to the bottles that you buy from the non-Jews and other that have wine in it or other types of drinks, right, that they only sell in their vessels. So he says, Mistaber lufiyani is daisy, lamed ayin dalet, right, in my humble opinion, she'ein srichan tefila, it doesn't require tefila, kasherosa achar shenei srachtu hakli lishtamish bo lamashkin acherin. Because you are then going to be using it for another... You're then going to use it for another usage. The time may who, and the reason is, he brings a proof from a mission in Meister Shani, which we will not get into. V'yesh lehakankan kedin or shel behema v'nimsa. Right, the bottom line here. V'nimsa shelo kana me'akum kli klal v'rak etzel Yisrael nase kli shelikal zed din tefila. He says, was when you bought something from the non-Jew, what did you buy? Right, you bought Snapple in a disposable container that you don't really have a care for. So then you all of a sudden decide, you know what? That's a very nice bottle. Right, I am now going to use it. Right, so who's the one that's turning it into a permanent vessel? You are. Right, the Jew is. So because the Jew is the one activating it as being a permanent vessel, so Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that it does not require tefillas kelim. The same would apply to. So there are some that say that one should maybe that's only by glass, maybe by metal you should be a little bit more strict about it, right? If you use those coffee canisters, maybe those do need to go. Certainly, I would if you have a chance to bring it to the mikveh, that's fine. But I certainly would not make a bracha on such a tefillah. Okay.
So wouldn't make any difference what you were using it for. Is that correct?
What?
Well,
the mitzvah of tefillas kelim is only on kli michael, on only things you eat, right? You don't have to tovel your pens. Right? Yeah.
What about like plastic containers?
The plastic doesn't require tefillah anyways. Plastic is plastic. It's only glass and metal that require tefillah.
If the whole reason for putting it...
What?
Maybe explain the underlying principle of why we need tefillah. What materials?
The pasuk there, where the pasuk that's describing tefillas kelim is only, it discusses several types of metal. So the Gemara extends that to glass. But beyond that, we don't do. So China, we don't have to bring to the mikvah. Clay, other types of clay things, we don't. Earthenware things don't require to the mikvah. Only things, actually, for this, only things that are mekabel tumah. That so clay isn't mekabel tumah. That's going to take us far afield. But yes?
If the whole reason for putting things in the mikvah was to distinguish between a temporary and a permanent vessel, right? If it's a temporary vessel, well, you said it's a mitzvah.
That's not the reason to...
Well, you said, like, a temporary vessel, we don't have to, and if it's a permanent vessel, we do.
Right.
Okay, so if the Snapple bottle, which was originally temporary, now we decided that we want to use it for the jelly beans.
Right.
So now it's a permanent vessel. How come that changing of status doesn't require...
That's not what requires a mikvah. Mikvah is required when you're changing something from being a non-Jewish vessel to a Jewish vessel.
Jew that owns the bottle now.
Right? If a Jew makes vessels themselves, right, that doesn't require it to be less scale.
You buy a challah knife, let's say. Depends where it's made.
Right.
In Israel,
right.
It's made by Jews.
Right, but when you look on the bottom and say, oh my gosh, it says made in China, right? Right, then you have to be careful.
No, but the bottle was originally owned by non-Jew, and then the Jew bought it.
No, but the Jew then made it. I mean, the glass, maybe I might have bought the sand for the glass from a non-Jew, right? But if I made it, so I made it.
So once you own the Snapple bottle, and then you decide what to you change it, so
right.
it's
your das is changing its status.
The Jew owns it.
Right, your knowledge is changing its status, as opposed to your money changing its status. It's just your money changing its status, and you're buying it. So then it's the, in a way, it almost requires, it's like a form of gavers that they talk about that's like we bring people to mikvah for them to become Jews, so we also bring vessels to the mikvah for them to become Jews. But if we make it ourselves, right? So we don't. We don't require the mikvah for it. But the Torah says it. The Torah only uses it for metal, and the Gemara extends it to glass. But it doesn't apply to other things. It doesn't.
If I buy something as a cooking pot or something,
right?
Like that, why doesn't the fact that it's transferred to me? Why don't I apply the same rule with the Snapple bottle as I do to a...
No, because you already bought it as a finished product. You bought it as something that I'm going to use. You're not doing anything to it.
Yeah, but my dot can change.
What was your das when you bought it? I'm going to have a one-time use crock pot. I mean, right? It's a final, right? You're buying it. It's clear when you buy something in the store, right? It's pretty clear with what are permanent, what are temporary things.
Clear what's the packaging and what is the product.
That's it.
Question.
Yes.
If you buy something that has an attractive package, which is meant to be used afterwards, for instance, coffee. Well, I bought coffee.
Decorative tin.
Right.
Right.
And
that's
you
true.
You do have to talk.
Yeah, if it's meant to be used, if it was created that way, then yeah, probably should be totaled. Yeah.
And what if you bought this coffee tin and you want to use it to bake a cake? Same thing. You have to total it.
If it's a permanent, it depends. What the company had in mind, if they made it as a permanent thing, right? So then you're buying a permanent thing that happens to have some chocolates in it, or happens to have some nuts in it, or whatever, coffee in it, right? But if it's a plain old those chock full of nuts or those right, those potatoes that right, all those things, so those the company intended that they'd be thrown out or recycled or hung to the back of just married cars. You know, be used
so what happens if a person is becoming more religious and they already own stuff that's not been toiled before?
Bring it to the
mikvah. Oh, so even if you've used it before, they can take it to the mikvah and it's okay?
Yes.
So you don't have to kasher that first?
Kasher first or last. They're separate mitzvahs. There's an idea of doing kasher, whatever. But sure, even if it's been in use, for sure it should be brought to the mikvah later on. So there's a question when someone is Megayer, someone became a, right, it's a very busy day. If someone that happens already has a family and they're like being Megayer with the whole family, right, so the day that they convert, very often they're converting, they get married, right, and have to bring, and they can't eat until they bring everything to the mikvah. So it's a pretty. I participated in one of these specifically. I remember did all three in the same day. Keiris, merit wedding, mikvah. It was quite exciting. Yes. All right. So.
I would eat out.
You have a fancy one.
They only took one day off from work. They couldn't. All right, just in the 10 minutes left, the discussion about blood spots. So the rest of these, I guess, in a way, were chumras. I'm not sure chumras or kulas. We said that everything has to be total. All right, we said that everything has to be kosher. So those are, I guess, in a way, two chumras. This is a kula, that there is a myth that this is like a terrible, terrible thing, something you have to be very, very, very nervous about. And when all the dust settles, it's not something that you have to be so nervous about. So the Gemara tells us, and Shulchan Aruch tells us as well, that birds that were fertilized, I mean eggs that were fertilized, right, so, and there's blood inside of those eggs, right, so that's not kosher, right, that you shouldn't eat that egg because it's a fertilized chicken or whatever, that's actually might be chicken blood, and therefore you shouldn't eat it. Okay, so that's the first halacha in Shulchan Aruch. However, if you don't think that there were that it was fertilized, so how do you think that it wasn't fertilized, right? One way you might think, no, that's not fertilized, that there were no roosters around, right? And apparently, Bisman Hazeh in America, right, there are pretty much no eggs on the commercial market that where the chicken was anywhere near a rooster at any point. Right, so technically speaking, though it is kemat impossible for this to be a problem. So the Shulchan Aruch does talk about such a situation, and that's actually source number 12, that these types of eggs, beitzim hamuzros, afilu yashpa, that they were totally, they certainly weren't fertilized. Afilu yashpa tarnagolas aleihem yayin rabin, even if the tarnagol, the chicken, was on it for many days, mutr la'achlam uvachi yizruk adam, you're allowed to eat them, says the Shulchan Aruch, as long as one throws out the blood. Okay, so number one is that it doesn't. This type of blood is probably not really blood. It's probably some kind of stain, or it might be some kind of a form. Whatever it is, it's not really this type of blood that would actually be prohibited. But yet the Shulchan Aruch says that if you need that egg, if you alone open it up and the egg has some blood in it, so you got to throw out the blood. So is that how we hold? So Rav Avi Yosef actually holds that way. Yeah, Rav Avi Yosef says that bisman hazeh, that you open up an egg, you look at it, right? There's an egg in it. There's a little bit of blood in it, so you throw out the blood, and the rest of the egg would be perfectly usable. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, that he agrees with all of that. How can he not agree? It says in Shulchan Aruch that really you only have to throw away the tiny little blood spot. But Rav Moshe writes about Lamaisa came the Beitza lo nechshav leruva the ruva anashim hefsid klal, that to lose one egg, I think the average cost of an egg today is like something less than 10 cents, right? So because there's not really that much of a loss involved by losing one egg, chazin sheich miru vebeitza kol hashitas, afshu rak midraban shahayelano leil kahakel, right? Even though that really you could come up with all sorts of kulas that it's really not a problem and you could keep it around or whatever. Right, and we're being super, super, super machmir with eggs, even more so than we are with certain biblical prohibitions. That, come on, you know, you find a blood spot in the egg, you may as well throw out the entire egg, because really, what's the big deal, right? You know, it's really not so much. So Rav Moshe says they really should throw out the entire egg. Rav Yosef says not. Some point out, as this might actually be a little bit of based on where they live, that Rav Yosef is passing in the Eretz Yisrael, where, you know, people don't have as much money, and the eggs might be a little bit more expensive, and it might actually be more of a hefsid. Rav Moshe was in America, where, like, you know, eggs, you know, you can throw them away. It's not such a big deal. What?
And the roosters are smarter.
Right. Right. So, You would add in more in America today. Also, hold on. So Mutter Lechol Beitz. So the Ramah adds in also that technically speaking, the source number 14. Technically speaking, one does not even have to check eggs. V'chein ein tzarich livdok habeitzim yesh behem dam. The somchen al rov beitzim she'ein behem dam. That he thinks that probably one that. It was very rare, right? It was really a miut. It was really only a small, minute amount of eggs that actually would have a blood spot under the conditions during the time of the Ramah, right? Technically speaking, you don't even have to check for blood. Umikol makom, however, the Ramah concludes by saying, Umikol makom nagu lahachmir kishosen meichel im beitzim bayom shirom behem imish behem dam. However, still the custom is to be strict, to look and eyeball them to see if there is blood within them or not. That's what the Ramah says. Yes.
I actually find that even in America, with brown eggs, more often than not, I get a lot of blood spots.
More often than not? Wow.
More
okay.
Often than not. And in Israel, it's I've thrown out.
Right. They say it's a little bit more with the brown eggs. They say because in America they actually check for blood themselves, meaning they in the factories they candle them, or what they call candling. I mean, you know, the polite. Modern day candling.
I have three in a dozen.
Right, okay. So Ramah says, technically speaking, you don't really have to check because it's such a rarity that they check. However, the custom is in our houses, and probably the custom is in most of our houses, that we do check. So if you look at the Starkey website, so it has an article concerning industrial situations about eggs, and here he actually quotes, right? Says the Ramah quotes the Minogdan in order to follow all opinions, the entire egg should be discarded regardless of where the blood spot was found. This is indeed the custom in kosher households. Were this to be the requirement for industrial eggs, however, it would be impossible to guarantee that such eggs are free of blood spots. The processing of eggs is monitored by factory workers, not the mashgiach, and with thousands of eggs being processed every hour, it is impossible to guarantee absolutely no blood, despite the USDA kosher statement. Indeed, new egg processing equipment is being designed that eliminates human oversight entirely. Fortunately, such a rigorous oversight is not halachically required. So basically, the Star K is saying that they don't require, basically in their factories where they have tons of eggs going in, they don't even check for blood spots at all. So, he's saying that in a household situation, so you should check, but in an industrial situation where
they use the eggs for cooking.
Right, you buy cookies, so cookies with a star K on it have not been checked for blood spots. So, yes, I think we should still be, you know, be chushish for the Ramah and still look for blood spots, etc. But, you know, and personally in our houses.
Why would we be obligated to it not be okay?
First of all, was the Ramah asked us to. That's one good reason too. Second reason is because it's much more it's viable for us to do so. I mean, we could do it. I mean, you make eggs in the morning, so what's the big deal? So you pop it into a cup and then you pop it into your pan. You could, right? What he's saying is that in this, if you want to pay an extra, you know, dollar a bag for cookies that were checked for blood spots, so fine. But he's saying just the economy won't allow it. Otherwise, there won't be any.
There's no need to do it.
That's not true. That's not true. We have a concept. We have plenty. We have concept all over your idea, the concept of Hesed Merubah, or the idea that there would be a loss, or the idea that you know, if possible, you should do this, or when it's easy, you should try this, or when you know that concept exists all over halacha. That you do the best you can under certain types of scenarios. You can't always do the best. You can't always do as well as you would like. Okay. Anyway. Yes.
Can you possibly find blood spots?